Thank you all for being with us for this edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Yes, it's true, it's Thursday, but we are on the air. It's part of our new five-day-a-week schedule, which we're really pleased that we were able to move to in this extraordinary election year. Today, you know, we've spent a good part of this week talking a lot about what's happening in state politics. And today we're going to make a turn and talk with a really smart panel about national and international affairs. And certainly we want to spend some time talking about Iran and all the questions that have been raised as a result of the targeting and killing of Qasem Soleimani. And we've got a terrific panel to do that today. We start with Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who is going to be with us on many of our Thursdays. Now that you are here, a resident of the city of Atlanta, having left Washington behind. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Much more relaxed now that I live in Georgia and not D.C.
I said that to you right before you went on the air, and I think other people may be interested in knowing this, too. Given how extraordinary the action is in Washington right now, you're not sorry that you're not there to have a front row seat for all of it?
Not at all. I was saying I spent more or less 10 years on Capitol Hill watching the circus. And you see how kind of cyclical it is, how you go, you careen from crisis to crisis, and it gets kind of repetitive.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're here in Atlanta. Very glad you're here. We're also joined today by Jackie Gingrich Cushman. Jackie is a conservative writer. She writes a regular column that you can read on townhall.com. And also is the author. You took the book.
I did take the book. Here, you can have it back.
Her newest book, Our Broken America, Why Both Sides Need to Stop Ranting and Start Listening. How's that book doing?
It's doing well. And so far, I mean, the main thing is I've had no one tell me that we should have more ranting about politics. So I'm pretty happy about that. At least the premise is good, right?
We are anti-ranting here on Political Rewind, as you well
exactly.
know.
Exactly. And I talk about that in the start of Our Broken America, that part of why I wrote this book is because of my experience here with you.
That's
on
really
Political
lovely.
Rewind.
That's
because
such a nice
this is
thing.
One of the few places you can go and have real discussions without people screaming.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Scott Hocum, State Representative Scott Hocum, is with us today, too. Scott, you're getting set for the new session of the Georgia General Assembly. And while we're going to want to be talking about that a lot in the weeks ahead, today we call on you primarily because of your exceptional background in military legal affairs. Among other things, you were one of the attorneys involved in looking at international law and the use of force around the Afghanistan and Iraqi invasions. Is that right? You were a consultant to three-star generals who were looking at rules of warfare and that sort of thing. You taught at the Samnun International School of Government. Tell us a little bit more about what that means.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be back. I spent 6 years on active duty, 3 years with the 3rd Infantry Division down at Fort Stewart, deployed with them to Bosnia. And then after Bosnia, I transferred to Fort McPherson, which is just south of Atlanta, now closed. But I signed in there in the summer of 2001. It was supposed to be a more relaxed assignment, but as we know, the world changed in September of 2001. And I was immediately reassigned to be the legal advisor on international law for the 3-star who commanded all ground forces during the initial phases of Afghanistan. And then my reward for 2 deployments was a 3rd. And I advised the commanding general for all of our ground forces during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And I worked on targeting decisions, rules of engagement, how we treat detainees and prisoners of war, both from a strategic level, operational level, down to a tactical level. So this is something I both care a lot about and also have some experience
with. Which is why I'm really happy you were able to find time to be with us today. So I thank you for that. We're also joined, and if you're watching us on Facebook Live, you will see that he is sitting right across from Representative Hocum, Dov Wilker, who is the Southeast Regional Director of the American Jewish Committee. And Dov, it's great to have you here today, partly because we know that Israel has certainly been very much in the thoughts of many people since the Soleimani death, but also because later in the show we're going to talk about a report from AJC, American Jewish Committee in this case, that talks about concerns about the growth of anti-Semitism and how the Jewish community across the country feels about
it. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me on today, Bill. I think, you know, both related to Israel and Iran, as you know, what's going to happen, the likelihood of Israel being targeted by Iran,
right,
as well as the views and attitudes of American Jews on the rise of anti-Semitism, which we just saw a few weeks ago, 10 anti-Semitic attacks in a 7-day period over the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. I think it's had a really great impact on the Jewish community, not just in Atlanta or in Georgia, but really across the United States and around the world.
And we will get to that after we talk about the first part of the show, which is Iran. I want to read a few top news stories that relate to our conversation today. President Trump, of course, answered questions today during an event at the White House. He suggested that there was intelligence that Soleimani was looking to blow up, he said, a U.S. embassy. Here's the exact quote. "We caught a total monster. We took him out, and that should have happened a long time ago. We did it because they were looking to blow up our embassy. We did it also for other reasons that were very obvious." Asked later about his comment that Iran was trying to blow up the American embassy in Baghdad, Trump referenced protests at the embassy at the start of the week. He said it was obvious, based on those protests, what Iran's intentions were. The House of Representatives under Speaker Pelosi's leadership tomorrow is this afternoon going to take up a war powers bill in which they are going to demand that President Trump come to Congress to get approval if he intends to have any further military action against Iran, and will call on him to cease any such activities if he tries to move forward without their approval. Why don't we just start with that right there? And I think, Tamar, let me turn to you first on this, because we're going to talk a lot on the show today, I think, about the War Powers Act and how the attack on Soleimani has really put it in the spotlight again.
Exactly. And Congress, over the last 4 decades, really has ceded a lot of its power, especially you know, across the board on all sorts of areas, but particularly when it comes to foreign policy acts of war. You know, you've seen presidents take more and more aggressive actions without Congress maybe filling them in later. And you've seen Congress, frankly, especially Democrats who've been kind of bitten by past votes, especially the vote to authorize the Iraq War back in 2002. And so there's a lot of different dynamics at play here. You have lawmakers who are very frustrated in this situation that the Trump administration didn't explain a lot to them. You know, behind closed doors, even in classified settings, they're not really sharing a lot of intel. You see Democrats very upset about that. You know, and you've also seen in the past, Republicans, this foreign policy has kind of been the one area where they have been willing to rebuke the president a little bit to a certain point. So it'll be really interesting to see how many Republicans cross over this afternoon to support this, because in theory, we're talking about the authority of Congress as a co-equal branch of government. You'd think that every member of Congress would want that, but there's more going on here.
You know, Scott, I think that Tamar just said something. She offered us a distinction here. Yes, the House will take up a resolution on the War Powers Act, but there is also concern on the Hill, and it's expressed more by Democrats and Republicans, although some Republicans have gotten in the mix on this, that no congressional leaders of either party were briefed on this before it took place. Separate matter entirely from whether Congress should have the right to decide whether the president launches an attack.
That's true. And I think the tradition is to do that. And I think that it's very important to do that, notwithstanding individual personality conflicts of respects of the roles of the offices. And I was going to highlight that there is some Republican concern in terms of what's been briefed as to the imminent nature of the threat. Now, if it's true that there were plans underfoot in terms of bombing the embassy, that would certainly be very serious and very significant. But that had not been briefed in the initial stages. And it's important, I think, both from a domestic viewpoint and an international viewpoint, to be very transparent and clear in terms of the reasons why we're using force. You want to also protect your intelligence gathering methods, but you need to be able to make the case on why we're using force and how it's going to make us safer long term.
You know, Jackie, I have watched your Twitter this week in terms of some of the comments you've made about being supportive of the president's decision to take this action. But I've heard your dad talk about it, too, on Fox News. But I can't help but wonder if your dad were as Speaker of the House, how he would have felt not being given any kind of background on what was about to take place.
So I think this is what makes this particular instance so interesting, is because I think if you think about the structure and what should happen, just from a kind of governance standpoint, right, the process and how it should play out, we can talk about that, and my guess is that we're going to be a lot of agreement in terms of how the process should work. And then if you look at kind of where we are today, right or wrong, it's kind of like the political reality of what's happening right now in Washington. And you have a House that recently passed impeachment. You have Speaker Pelosi, who's now hasn't even turned over the articles of impeachment yet. So you have this kind of this very weird dynamic. You have a Senate that's run by Republicans. And so I think, if you look at the whole kind of where we are as a country with the political laid on top of the governance issues, I think it gives you a different lens, and we can discuss the two different lenses. But clearly, I think my dad actually talked about it recently, maybe he told me, I can't remember. But, when he was Speaker, clearly he got briefed. And we can talk about the governance and what should be done properly. But if you look at the actual act of what happened, and you look at assuming that there was some active intelligence, and I would assume that that's true if that was stated, that there was going to be an attack on an embassy, then it makes sense. And we can talk about the history of Iran and how long it's been going on. But we've been, we've had a problem with them for 40 years. I mean, in the 70s, they were chanting death to America as we were, trying to negotiate with them. So this is a longstanding problem. Clearly, the problem has not been solved. But I'm really glad we're talking about this several days after when we saw the attack back. No lives were lost, no U.S. lives, no lives at all. And kind of hopefully this de-escalation is hopefully where we are today.
I want to just pick one more thing, and then I want to bring you in, Dove. But actually, as I asked you the question about your dad, it suddenly reminded me that while President Clinton was under impeachment by the House, which was led by your dad, he did prepare. He launched an attack against
Desert Fox.
Right.
Yes.
And your dad and other leaders of the opposing party were brought in and briefed.
And I was going to say, yeah, exactly. And he was briefed. But again, I think it's a little difference in that, yes, it was an impeachment, and yes, that was the process. But unlike this, it is so much more political and politicized. And this, the impeachment is like the one of the 45th different things that President Trump has been defending against Democrats, right or wrong. We can discuss each one individually. But I think this president, quite frankly, probably was uncertain whether or not he could trust certain people, and probably withheld information due to that, that concern.
Dove?
Yeah, I think the American political side of this is very interesting. But I'd also say, we talked, Jackie, you'd mentioned the de-escalation. One of the things that I frankly think we should all be paying attention to, and we're not, is Iran's proxies throughout the Middle East and what they're going to be doing. It's very easy to look at Iran and say, okay, they fired ballistic missiles at an Iraqi Air Force base, but we're not paying attention to what Hezbollah is doing in Lebanon, what is going on in Syria, what might be happening in northern Africa. I think it's not as simple as these two, these rockets were fired, these missiles were fired, and it's over.
Yeah,
the de-escalation is done.
So, Scott, again, with your legal background on this, start us off, if you would, in terms of the conversation about the War Powers Act. Help us understand to what extent a president of the United States — Tamara's already reminded us that American presidents have been gobbling up power when it comes to military actions and avoiding taking it to Congress. But what is the actual law in the War Powers Act tell us we need to be doing?
The War Powers Act requires notification to Congress. My memory on it is a little hazy, to be candid. I'm more an expert on the international application of force.
Okay.
But it does require notification to Congress. And then usually the threshold issue is just if it's going to be something that's more than a one-time operational issue, it's a much more sustained fight. And I actually have a fairly robust view of Article 2. I think the president has the authority to do what he did last week. without congressional authorization, but I think if this were to continue to escalate, then we would absolutely need to get Congress involved.
Okay, Tamara, you want to jump in?
So the War Powers Act gives the administration 48 hours to notify Congress about strikes that they may have taken preemptively.
What kind of strikes, of course, is the question.
Yeah, and that's not versed on.
Well, because it's squishy.
And then Congress can, Congress in theory gets a briefing, and then they can pull the plug, and they can say, if we don't approve, you have 30 days to get out, or we approve and you can keep going. The issue, and you're seeing a lot of members, especially in the Senate, bristle about this, is the last, gosh, how long has it been? But all of the action in the Middle East has come from a vote Congress took to authorize use of military force in 2002 to invade Iraq. That's the last time Congress has really weighed in on this. You've seen such a reticence to do that. And it's for a lot of reasons. Across the board, you've seen a growth of executive power. But I think members of Congress are wary, first of all, of being put on the record to have people like me, journalists, come up 10 years later and be like, hey, you voted for this, 10 years ago. Isn't that a bad vote? Or I think there's also a pressure.
And we've seen a lot of that in the years after the Iraq vote.
Exactly. Not only that, but you don't want to cross your party's president. So.
Yeah.
Jackie,
here's what's okay. So, none of us is experts on the War Powers Act per se, but Soleimani was a state actor. In other words, this wasn't a president deciding to respond to, well, I guess Trump would say he was responding to the attack that killed an American businessman. So I get that. But this was a targeting of a state actor. And today, when reporters had a chance to ask the president questions, he was asked specifically, would you take out the head of state? Would you take out Khomeini, who is actually the head of state in Iran, without coming to Congress? And that's where this becomes really a tricky issue. Can you essentially assassinate a state leader without authorization?
I'm not asking you for the legal side of it.
No, this isn't about the law.
I can barely hire lawyers. That's the extent of my legal ability. Now, I do think there is a lot of concern, but the challenge is, if you think about the separation of powers, is that so many things happen so fast today. It's not like, it's not like we're in the early 1900s where you have to, you can watch ships cross the ocean and you can watch tanks go. So, now it's so fast, it can happen so rapidly, not to mention it's not only the actual actors, but the money, to your point, funneling through different organizations that are terrorist organizations and the money from the, that are spreading this terror. And so the question becomes, how do you prevent that? And if there is an actual attack on a U.S. embassy that is going to happen, what do you need to do to make sure that doesn't happen? And so I think it is a lot more complicated than it used to be for a variety of reasons. And I do think you've got a real good point that, part of the problem is, yes, we want things taken care of, but no, if you're sitting in this, if you're sitting in your elected official going to be elected in two more years or in a year now or less than a year, do you want to vote on something that you have limited knowledge about that everyone's going to second guess you? And I think it makes it very complicated.
All right, let's do this there were people who came out of the briefing that the administration finally gave to members yesterday. It was an intelligence briefing that we're not being given many details about what was discussed in there. What I find, by the way, fascinating about that is President Trump today suggested that they were going to attack our embassy. It'd be interesting to learn whether that was part of a briefing yesterday or not. Angus King, certainly no fan of the president, Senator King, did come out of the briefing and tell reporters, yeah, I thought they gave us some evidence that there were things that we should be concerned about. But Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who's always been suspicious about Article II powers, came out to talk about how he felt. Many of you have heard this already. It's worth listening to again.
When we send our brave soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines into harm's way, we owe the American people the decent courtesy to follow the Constitution, to debate and discuss these actions. For them to tell us that either through a War Powers Act resolution or otherwise, for us to debate and discuss these things on the Senate floor would somehow weaken the American cause and embolden Iran in any other actions. I find very insulting. I also want to make clear that I walked into that briefing undecided as to whether to support the resolution under the War Powers Act. And I can say that after that briefing is what changed my mind. That briefing is what brought me on board.
Scott, Mike Lee was far from the only senator who came out of that briefing and said they didn't tell us anything more than we can read in the papers every day.
Right. And I'm skeptical about this new purported reason, and I'll tell you why. Soleimani wasn't doing the work. So how do we know that the threat, the imminent
threat—
What does
that mean, he wasn't doing
the
work?
He wasn't going to actually go and bomb the embassy. Somebody else would have done it. He would have been part of the operational level plan.
But he would have been directing.
He would have been directing it.
Okay. Directing it, but that doesn't mean that that takes away the ability of whoever was in place to still do it. So how do we know that those individuals that were going to execute the plan
aren't still there to,
do it? And have we truly eliminated that purported imminent threat, if that actually is true, which we don't know? And this administration has a very loose relationship with the truth, and I think that it harms it when it comes up with explanations very far after the
fact.
But the attack,
I mean, in the attack, it wasn't just Soleimani that was killed, but it was his number two as well. So the decision-making apparatus of the Al-Quds force is really was what was eliminated. And so if anything, I tend to agree with whether the imminence of the attack was going to take place, it is clearly has been set back.
Tamar, I think what we get down to, and Scott really kind of hinted at it, is this is something that people have talked about for 3+ years of the Trump presidency. He has an issue with telling the truth. I mean, even Republicans say that. This is not a partisan thing to say. The president is a fabulist in many instances. And so when he tells us these things at a time when Americans should be pulling, would in many other instances be pulling together against a foreign foe, and no one thinks Soleimani wasn't a bad, bad man, we tend to be skeptical.
Well, it's interesting. Trump, over the last year especially, has been moving to pull out the U.S. out of the Middle East. So this kind of goes against what he was trying to do. At the same time, he wants to undo the legacy of what President Obama did, not only in the U.S., but around the world. That includes the Iran nuclear agreement. But at the same time, he wants to project this idea of American dominance around the world. And I am a strong leader, and don't question me or the U.S. So it's interesting to see how that decision making has played out in his administration.
Jackie, how does when yesterday, when he gave his formal speech yesterday morning, 9-minute speech, which, you know, it seemed to me he gave the speech that he ought to have given. It was somber. He told Iran, don't try anything. You know, there were mixed messages, but that's beside the point. He couldn't resist taking a shot at the Obama administration, even in the middle of that. And I know you're a Republican and that you support much of what the president stands for. But is it necessary to continue attacking a previous administration on the day after we've exchanged essentially actions of war with Iran?
So I'm not going to talk about whether it's necessary or not, but I think his point was, and this goes back to your point earlier about proxies and about money, is I'm not sure I'd have done it in that manner. Let's put it that way, but but I do think he's got a valid point, and I'll tweet the study later. But there's a study that said it looked at money that flows through Iran to different proxies, right?
Well, let's be clear. He claimed that the money that paid in the Iran negotiation,
but again, money's fungible, as we all know. You give me $100, and I spend money. It's all money's here, there, and everywhere. So it's not like, you know, you take $1 and you walk it over and you hand it to somebody else. You get money in and you take money out. But if you look at where the money goes, Syrian receives approximately $6 billion a year. You know, if you look at that, $700 million is for Hezbollah in Lebanon. If you look at Yemen, $100 million a year. Afghanistan militants get $2 million a year. Various groups in Gaza, including Hamas, get about $100 million a year.
But the question
now, is it the same exact dollars that we sent over? I mean, who knows? But the fact is there is money being spread all over the Middle East.
Scott, let me ask you. At a moment of a somber moment, we've exchanged military action with a foreign power. To what extent does the president help bring us together by having to attack the Obama administration in the middle of this somber moment?
It doesn't. And he has no interest in that. He never has had any interest in the United States country. That's not who he is. And I will say, in terms of just a couple of things that were talked about, Overall, it is certainly better that Soleimani is gone. There's no question about that. I think the concern that people have expressed is just, will the ripple effects cause more harm and more danger? Mm-hmm. That is an unknown. We don't know ultimately where that is going to go. And I think Dove raised an important point in terms of the proxies, the threat of cyber, like all of these types of things need to really be thoughtfully examined in terms of where we go. I can say this with pretty strong certainty, we are not done. And so the question is, where does this go forward?
It is interesting, Dove, that Israel has gone out of its way to distance itself from this attack. They've really pulled back. And the question, you brought it up before, we still don't know whether Iran is going to give a green light to Hezbollah to begin once again attacking Israeli interests and beyond.
Well, it's interesting. There's a great book that was published called A Rise and Kill First. It was about Israel's targeted assassination program. It was written by Ronan Bergman. And in the book, there's a story from November 2015 that Israel had they were following an Iranian commander, and they found him in Syria. And all of a sudden, Soleimani showed up. And they called the head of the Mossad, who was sitting Shiva, one of his parents' relatives had just passed away. So he calls him in the middle of Shiva, who then gets in touch with the prime minister and says, we've got Soleimani, can we take him out? And they said, no, you can only take out the target that you have approval for, and that's not Soleimani. So the idea that Israel is going to be targeted is, it's not just, Israel's involvement is very deep in this whole issue of the Middle East and the intelligence sharing between the United States and Israel. What happens with Hezbollah? They've got hundreds of thousands of rockets on Israel's northern border. I mean, the next fear of war is absolutely coming from the north. And while everybody's hoping that it won't happen, this definitely increases the weariness of the Israelis and Jewish targets and Israeli targets around the world.
Let me do this. Let me get a break in. I do want to talk a little bit more. We've really talked about it in a way. We've skirted around it. I want to talk about how the kind of toxic partisan atmosphere in Washington creates for all of us a dissonance that's hard to, I think, reconcile with the seriousness of the moment. Let's do that. But first, these messages.
My name is Peter Broadhead. My wife and I own Brighter Day Natural Foods Market in Savannah. We've been in business, this will be our 40th year. We are a natural foods market. We've been underwriting with Georgia Public Broadcasting, and it's been very, very effective. We're reaching people that are very thoughtful and just want to get more in-depth information. So when our name comes up, they're in that thinking process and they're not tuning us out.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
President Trump says Iran appears to be standing down after a missile attack targeting U.S. forces in Iraq.
Which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
Iranians have been strengthened. He's united Iranian society in a way which I think he hasn't comprehended.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a view from Iran this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6 right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jackie Cushman, Dove Wilker, Representative Scott Holcomb, senior reporter Tamar Hallerman in the studio today. Tamar, you have just extricated yourself from the incredibly toxic atmosphere on Capitol Hill these days. I want to ask you, once I've done this, you start the conversation about some of the remarks that have been made, one of them last night on Lou Dobbs' show by our very own Doug Collins. He's talking now about Nancy Pelosi.
I did not think she could become more hypocritical than she was during impeachment. But guess what? Surprise, surprise. Nancy Pelosi does it again, and her Democrats fall right in line. One, they're in love with terrorists. We see that. They mourn Soleimani more than they mourn our Gold Star families, who are the ones who suffered under Soleimani. That's a problem. Let me say, as someone who has a very real constitutional issue with the War Powers Act to start with, I mean, this is just another, again, blatant hypocritical act by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats because they don't like the president.
All right. First of all, Tamar, feel free to react however you want to that really extraordinary statement by Collins. He doesn't believe that Democrats are in love with terrorists, does he?
I mean, it just shows the atmosphere on Capitol Hill that if you show any sort of, you know, you're going to question anything and it's immediately, oh, it's because you're one way or another, you love the president, you hate the president, and that's all that this could be. And there's not much room for much dissent in either way. And you've seen that with our congressional delegation over the last week as well. You see all of the Republicans racing to say, I agree with what the administration did. It was the right rule. And you see the Democrats saying, oh, you know, Soleimani was not great, but still, you know, let's pump the brakes on this. And so it's going to pretend, you know, at 4 o'clock when they vote finally on this resolution, I'm expecting a pretty party line vote. Yeah. where maybe a couple decades ago, we would have seen a more bipartisan thing.
Well, the Iraq war vote.
Sure. And more about, you know, the will of Congress as a co-equal body and asserting your sense of self.
You know, Jackie, I bring it to you. Doug Collins he doesn't believe Democrats love terrorists. He doesn't really think that. He was egged on by Lou Dobbs. If you watch that whole interview, if you were to go look it up online, Dobbs led him right to the trough, and he drank it in big measure.
Well, I didn't see the whole clip, so I can't speak to that. But, I mean, I don't know what Congressman Collins thinks or what he believes. But I can say, I do think you're right. I mean, I think it's very hard when you sit in a very partisan. He's just gone through the whole impeachment. You know, he's obviously, I mean, there are talk about clips of Doug Collins everywhere. Just look up anywhere in video, and he's in some of the impeachment hearings, you know, talking about, you know, X, Y, and Z, what's happening. So it is a very partisan environment. And I think he's very, you know, sick of being in a partisan environment. And this is kind of his way of saying, you know, the president's trying to do the right thing, and he agrees with the president. And so, therefore, I think, you know, he's down the party line. I think it's too bad. I'm not saying I agree with him. I'm just saying we've got a very polarized environment.
Let me say the obvious thing that listeners of your show, of course, know is that Doug Collins is, of course, eyeing a run for Senate at the end of next year. Yeah. So, or at the end of this year. I'm sorry. We're in 2020. but to filter all of this through that prism, he's looking at potentially running against Kelly Loeffler, and he's going to run to her right.
Scott, when I say that I don't think Doug Collins really believes that, I'm not suggesting he should be excused for having said it. I want to make that clear. Stop tweeting if you're doing that right now. That was an incredibly outrageous comment to make.
It's inexcusable. I deployed 3 times. I have friends who are buried in Arlington. To say that it makes me angry is an understatement. It's completely disrespectful, and Doug knows better. That's all I'm going to say about it.
You were living in a world where, you know, Jackie, everybody's making pretty outrageous statements these days. Here's your book, which is about civility. When you say that Collins is sick of the partisanship, I didn't get the sense that he was trying to break free of it in those remarks.
I do talk a lot about this, and I think that's part of our problem is that when one side gets really, it's both sides. I'm not saying that it's one side or the other. That when one side starts, the other side amps it up, and it's like this never-ending vortex of screaming. And I don't think it's helpful. And so people often say, well, you just want Republicans to give up and give in. And I said, that's actually not my point. But if you can't listen to the other side and you can't articulate your position better, then you need to rethink your position or learn to communicate it better. And that's what I talk about in A Broken America, is it doesn't help to keep screaming your perspective. It's like having teenagers. You don't want them to just sit there and scream at each other. You want to understand what people are thinking and then actually have a real discussion and then solve problems.
I recognize that partisanship is certainly a problem, but there are, and that's really all we hear about, but there are issues that does unite where you do see bipartisanship. I mean, and Doug Collins is the First Step Act. You know, they've taken steps, they've taken actions that have brought our partisan politicians together. So I think on the one hand, you know, we often talk and almost double down on promoting the idea of partisanship in politics today and in D.C. And I know it's there. I'm not discounting it, but I do think that there is an understanding that they need to be partisan. And when it comes though to defending, that there needs to be bipartisan. But when it comes to defending the president, I think that's where it's usually along those lines more than anything.
I just find it frightening to think that we no longer are able to come together as a nation when there's some foreign action that threatens in any way the safety of people in the United States.
And something you heard lawmakers venting after this classified briefing the other day, you know, when the administration wasn't giving folks the answers that they thought they deserved. One of the defenses was, oh, this could lead to a security breach if we tell members of Congress, you know, who have security clearances and are typically briefed on stuff like this. But one thing I wanted to say, going off what Dov said, is that a lot of these lawmakers, even the most partisan among them, you talk to them off the record, and most of them realize that this is a game, and they sort of have a role to play, and they can tell you very clear-eyed off the record, oh, I realize this is, you know, a little crazy, or I'm maybe taking a harsher stance than I would just having a beer with you, but this is the role I need to play.
Scott, how do you react to hearing that?
I think it's shameful, and I don't agree with it. And one thing, the Georgia General Assembly is not perfect, but we actually do a pretty good job of bipartisanship and listening to each other. And one thing that I don't think we do a lot is to just blanket it as a party thing. We will call out individuals for their role and responsibility. And if Doug wants to call out individuals, do that. But to make a blanket sweeping statement that half the country or half of your state is wrong, I don't accept that. I don't.
I have to give you one quick personal reaction to that. After the 1998 impeachment of President Clinton, where the atmosphere on Capitol Hill became as poisonous almost as it is today, I really got to the point where, as much as I had loved covering Washington, and I did, I preferred being back here covering the state legislature, where I did think people were trying to work together. In the long run, you know what? Even Jackie Cushman's dad, Newt, realized that the toxicity of the environment led him to have to leave Washington.
But it is hard. But if you think about, I think you had a good point earlier, like if you're talking about talking points, I mean, for people in Washington to get covered by, you know, the cable channels, et cetera, right? They're going to go to the people with the most, they're not going to cover a whole hour on the VA bill that was a bipartisan bill, or a whole hour on the
so
first
exciting.
Step, right? That's a bipartisan bill. So I think that is part of the challenge we have is, you know, what we pay attention to, people talk more about.
All right. I want to take on one more question about this before we take our final break and then move on in topics today. Scott, you raised a point during the break that I think is important to mention. Two things, really. Jackie Cushman earlier said, you know, Trump's the guy who didn't want it's actually tomorrow. Trump was trying to pull out of all these foreign entanglements. Now we've got more troops going into the Middle East. Trump does not need to destabilize American presence in Iraq, and now it appears that may be happening. The Iraqi government, as insecure as it is right now, is asking Americans to leave. What does that mean?
Right, coupled with the Pentagon making a mistake of offering a letter to withdraw and then saying that was just a mistake. How does that happen? So it is a very complicated, complex situation. I do not think that it would be in the United States' national security interest if we do withdraw from Iraq. One of the challenges for the national security team going forward is going to be to position forces in the event of contingencies, but not to make escalation inevitable. And it is a very difficult tightrope to navigate, but one that needs to be navigated as we move forward.
So let me go around and just a very, very quick response from each of you. I think you've already answered the question I want to ask. Are we safer today as a result of taking out Soleimani and the Iraqis, the Iranians having a rather measured response?
Is the world more stable? No. Are we safer? I think it remains to be seen, but I don't think that we're at the end of this. I would expect there to be some repercussions and more fallout. It probably will not be done at the official state level, but it will be done via covert operations, et cetera.
Dove, and with your particular interest in what happens to Israel, are we all safer today or not?
I'm going to agree with Scott on this one. I think it's too early to tell. I think that, and you know, one of the issues about targeted assassinations is you know the person that you're taking out. You don't necessarily know the person who's going to be replacing them. Yeah. And I think that's something that's also needs to be part of the consideration.
I think we're both safer and less stable. Right, you don't know what's going to happen. But I will say I think are much stronger as a nation.
Okay. Tamara, you get the last word before the break. Or would you rather be the reporter and say nothing?
I'll say nothing. I'll take that.
All right. Let's do this. Let's take our final break of the show and come back with more on Political Rewind.
Is your used car or truck creating stress in your life? Donate it to GPB where it can create more hours of your favorite programs instead. It's easy to give. We provide free and convenient pickup and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars to donate today. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks for supporting GPB.
On the next Fresh Air, the big story we're not talking about, the dangerously unstable relationship between the U.S. and China. We'll talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, whose new article is called The Future of America's Contest with China. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 right here on GPB. You can listen live online at gpbnews.org or download our GPB apps for your mobile devices.
Back on Political Rewind, my wife and I spent about 5 or 6 days over the Christmas holiday visiting our 23-year-old daughter up in New York, in Brooklyn. And while we were up there, of course, New York was experiencing a spate of anti-Semitic hate crimes, including a horrific incident in a community up in Rockland County outside of New York City, where a man broke into the home of a rabbi who was having a Hanukkah celebration, broke in with a knife and attacked, I think, 5 people. No one was killed, but there were injuries sustained. And law enforcement later found anti-Semitic literature, stuff that he'd looked up on the internet. And all of this, Dove, comes at a time when your organization, the American Jewish Committee, certainly the Anti-Defamation League, other Jewish organizations, are increasingly concerned about what's happening in this country with anti-Semitism.
Yeah, thank you very much, Bill. I'm actually originally from Bergen County, New Jersey, which borders Rockland County. And so I used to frequent Muncie often. And I know the community relatively well from my childhood. And to think that something like that could happen in a community like Muncie is really shocking to all of us. But it comes on the heels of, a murder at a synagogue in Poway, California, on the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. You know, there have been more.
Well, even more recently in New Jersey, what turned out to be looked like a shootout involving nothing more than criminals trying to escape law enforcement turned out to be, in fact, an anti-Semitic based attack.
Right. In Jersey City, they had the Black Hebrew Israelites intentionally went into a storefront that had a preschool behind it. I mean, it could have been a terrible and awful massacre of Jews. And, I think the Jewish community is absolutely on edge. We've seen anti-Semitic murders take place around the world, from Mumbai to France to Belgium. But in the United States, it's really sort of changed the way that the Jewish community has been thinking about it. So American Jewish Committee issued this groundbreaking survey of American Jewish attitudes. So often there have been surveys of the number of anti-Semitic attacks that have taken place, but nobody had actually ever asked how American Jews were feeling about anti-Semitism. And by all accounts, the Jewish community is feeling it, and it is not good.
I'll open this up to everybody. The first question that your survey asks, and this is based on, about 1,200 American Jews, all of them over the age of 18,
correct,
according to your research.
Yep.
How much of a problem, if at all, do you think anti-Semitism is in the United States today? And 88% say it's either a very serious or somewhat of a serious problem. Only 12% say that it's not much of a problem or not a problem at all. Tamar?
Well, yeah. As a young Jewish person, I'm surprised and I'm not surprised. I'm lucky enough as a millennial. I grew up in a time where I thought things were different from what my grandparents were experiencing in Poland. But it's kind of scary to see. And those numbers are very high and very scary.
Yeah.
What's interesting, and then Jackie and Scott, I want to get you in here. Dove, your organization, there are a lot of questions here. And in fact, why don't we... Sam and Tom, let's post a link to the survey on our social media so people can see all of the questions. But there are partisan questions on here. How much are Democrats responsible? Mm-hmm. How much are Republicans? And one of the questions, do you approve or disapprove of the way President Trump is handling the threat of anti-Semitism in the United States? 24% approve. 73% disapproved, Dove.
Yeah. Well, if you look at actually the previous question, it says, is your opinion of the job President Trump is doing favorable or unfavorable? So it was 22% were favorable and 76% were unfavorable. It's not surprising to me that the statistics show that because roughly 72% of American Jews vote Democrat, and I think it's become more of a partisan issue, unfortunately. If you're more a more observant Jew, you're more likely to be supportive of the president, versus if you're more liberal or Democrat or progressive, you're likely going to be against the president. But it is a problem because we do need the voice and the support of the president to combat anti-Semitism.
So, Jackie, let me ask you a general question and then also say, please drill down on that particular finding in the poll. You know as well as everybody who's listening to the show that there are people who believe that the president has inflamed hatred against specific groups in this country, not just Jews, LGBT and others. Give us your take on that, and then how you feel when you see that 73% of the people say that he's not doing a good job dealing with anti-Semitism.
So the first part about flaming hatred, I think that, quite frankly, if you look at his policies and what he's done, if you look at the fact that, you know, black unemployment is down greatly, it's very low, it's the best, it's the best it's ever been. He did the First Step Act. He's doing a lot of his policy.
The First Step Act being the one that forgives... people who've not committed violent crimes and is giving them opportunities to leave jail, to get job training, all that. Go ahead.
So
Doug Collins being a co-sponsor.
Thank you for talking about that. So, I mean, if you look at the policies, you know, that doesn't make sense. But then if you look at his speech, and when I really talk about it, and again, we can talk about this or talk about, we often talk about suburban women or suburban moms and how, you know, they're kind of disaffected as well. And I think of it more in tone and tenor. So, I mean, you almost separate, and maybe this is what's happening, which is what's going to be my question about the difference in, you know, Republican and Democrat in terms of how they align ideology in the survey and is in their approval of Trump. Is it more that it's the person of Trump versus the policies of Trump? And that was going to be my question is, and if you pull those two apart, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fair question. I do think the person versus the policy is a major issue. Because you look at the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's. Things that he's done to support Israel have been well received by the overall Jewish community. I think the numbers would probably be 75% of American Jews would support.
If you list out the policies about Israel.
But I think I do think that there's a struggle there for many American Jews to sort of wrap their heads around. There is a distinction between Israel and Jews, right? Not all Jews are Israeli. Not all Israelis are Jews. He has unfortunately used language that has said, you know, said to American Jews, your ambassador, when speaking about the Israeli ambassador. You know, there is a, I think that the policy, and I'm not sure that there's necessarily enough policies that support the Jewish community, not about Israel, but domestic issues,
Scott,
that we've been supporting.
Weigh in on this. We know that American Jews are overwhelmingly voting for Democrats. Trump's trying to change that equation, but an awful lot of Jews think that he has not done a thing to help in terms of anti-Semitism.
I'm not Jewish, so I don't know that I can
speak
about
that from a personal. But you know about the difference between work being accommodating, being humane, being warm, and being hostile. Right?
Yes, okay. And what I would say is from being a supporter of the Jewish community is I think that our leaders need to, at all times, be consistent in promoting a strong respect for tolerance, a strong respect for difference of religions. It's the only thing that really keeps countries together. And I think globally, it is very, very concerning to be in the year 2020 and see a very strong rise of nationalism and extreme right behavior, because what we're seeing with anti-Semitism, as Dove pointed out, is not limited to the United States. It's happening globally. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little shocked that we're here right now. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's like we're regressing. And the only real path forward is an absolute promotion of tolerance and inclusion and at all times a rejection of voices of hate.
Yeah. But I just want to add, you know, it's not just coming from the right, the far right, where the anti-Semitism is coming from.
Well,
you
look at Jeremy Corbyn.
Right, exactly. The Labour Party in the United Kingdom. I mean, a lot of, and even, you know, the attack in Muncie got a lot of publicity, but if it had been a white supremacists with a gun, it would have gotten even more. And so all of the attacks, unfortunately, that took place in New York and New Jersey over the Hanukkah timeframe were by people of color. And that is a concerning element as well. So we can't, it's not, anti-Semitism is not just from one political party or ideology. I mean, it is a parasite that
yes,
is affecting society.
But
your survey
agreed.
Suggests yep. that American Jews believe that Republicans mm-hmm. and the president yep. are more responsible for allowing anti-Semitism to exist than they are Democrats. But, of course, Tamar, that could possibly be in part because they already have a partisan viewpoint when they go in. They vote Democratic. But let me ask you this other thing, because I thought Dove said something really important. You know, Trump has absolutely gone out of his way to court strong supporters of Israel. Certainly the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities in the United States are thrilled with his policies toward Israel. And I'm supposing that it troubles him and surprises him that Jewish voters are not more in his corner. He basically has said that on a number of occasions. But Dove is right. It is not some monolithic community.
Sure, and I think there's some people who think that all Jews are basing their votes based on support for Israel. And while that's certainly true for some corners of the community, that's not true for everyone. So that's definitely a misconception. And I do think a lot of Jews will look and, you know, the comments that the president made after the Charlottesville rally, for example, you know, when you had white supremacists saying Jews will not replace us. And I think a lot of Jews saw his response and weren't so happy with that.
Jackie, let's go back to your book, because I try to take every opportunity I can to promote it. President Trump does not fit into the book that you in which you try to talk about how people can be more civil toward one another, more understanding.
No, he did not write my foreword. I didn't do that. No, and I do talk a little bit about Trump, but here's my, you know, and I've worked with a lot of different candidates. And, you know, in the end, they all get to choose how they talk, right? I mean, you know, you can tell them to do X, Y, and Z, but they all get to determine how they reach out to the people. And if he asked me for my advice in communications, I would give him some strong advice about how you need to reach out to people and be positive and not. I mean, there are a lot of things he could do. But, you know, he is a New York developer who had a reality TV show. And we knew that when we, right, when we voted for him, when the Americans voted for him, they knew that. So he has not changed who he is. I think for us as Americans, but he's different than what we're used to. So I think it's quite frankly a bit shocking to us to see someone who's so different from the presidents we've had, because he's not establishment, he's not a politician, he's a New York developer who had a reality TV show, and we should not be surprised with what we have.
All right. Scott Holcomb, I want to give you the last word. And the reason I do is you're getting set to go into the next session of the General Assembly next Monday. I've got to give you at least 20 seconds to finish us off on this subject.
It remains to be seen what that's going to be like. One thing, one piece of unfinished business that does tie to this conversation is the hate crimes bill.
Chuck F. Strachan has a hate crimes bill. It's got stalled in the Senate, but we're in the second year of a biennial, which means it is still alive.
Still alive.
Right?
I'd like to see that pass.
I'm glad you brought that up. I meant to do that, so thank you. I'm sorry to say we are totally out of time. Scott Holcomb, Dove Wilker, Jackie Cushman, Tamar Hallerman, thank you for a really terrific conversation today. We're back tomorrow, of course, at 2, and we got a lot of state political news that we're going to get back to on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. See you tomorrow.